Hare Krishna. Today, of course, is Lord Balaram's appearance day. By the way, just as a matter of interest, is anybody attending here for the first time? First time, anybody? No? Okay. Oops-a-daisy. So we spoke this morning about Lord Balaram, a little bit about Lord Balaram. And I think many of you were there. At least I can recognize quite a few faces that were there this morning. So rather than speaking on the same things, I thought I'd speak a little bit differently. So it may not be specifically about Lord Balaram. Although, as we spoke this morning, everything is coming. All our spiritual strength is coming from Lord Balaram. So in that sense, even if you think of the life of Srila Prabhupada, how much, you know, in that sense he would have drawn from the strength of Lord Balaram. But I just wanted to quote from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text 2, Raja Vidya Raja Guyam, Pavitram Idam Uttamam, Prachak Shavagamam Dharmyam, Susukam Kartamavyam. Those last two lines, all the lines, let's speak all the lines. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed. But those last two lines, the first two lines are factual in that sense. It's Rajavidya, it's the king of education. It's the most secret of all secrets. And the reason that it's the most secret of all secrets is because it's giving direct perception of the self by realization. And then, just as a really nice bonus, it is joyfully performed. So it's a happy thing. It's a glorious thing. It's not a difficult thing. Prabhupada would say so many times that Krishna consciousness is our original position. That's our original position is Krishna consciousness. It's not an artificial imposition. And therefore, because it's our original consciousness and our natural consciousness, it's a wonderful thing. It's a glorious thing. We may find, because we've been separated from it for a long period of time, we may find reconnecting ourselves to our original position is sometimes a little difficult. But that will pass, and we will again experience that bliss of being Krishna consciousness, being Krishna conscious. And as Krishna says here, it is joyfully performed, like that. So today, I picked that verse because Krishna consciousness is the king of education; it's the most secret of all secrets. Because it gives direct perception of the self by realization and it is joyfully performed. That anything else that we experience in the process of that, of our practice of Krishna consciousness, we should always see it in that context, even if something is somewhat challenging for us from time to time, different challenges that come. So in connection to that particular verse, I was thinking of one pastime in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the pastime in the Srimad Bhagavatam that I was thinking of was when it was just at the advent of the start of this particular age, Kali Yuga, just at the very beginning of this age. And what was happening was one of the things that's unique to the Kali Yuga, very unique to Kali Yuga, is the killing of animals, and in particular, the killing of cows. That's unique to Kali Yuga. That didn't take place in any of the other previous yugas before. Now, of course, it's completely second nature. It's actually incredible when you think about it. It's just completely second nature. In fact, when Prabhupada first came, and devotees... In fact, I read an article some years ago where they were attributing the spread of vegetarianism in the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, they were attributing, even though it was indirect, even my own, I became a vegetarian before I met the devotees, but I later found out that the person who encouraged me to become vegetarian, that they themselves had become vegetarian through contact with devotees. So even indirectly, it was as a result of devotees and Krishna consciousness that I became vegetarian. So the article was expressing that, you know, some, I think they said something like 85% of the spread of vegetarianism can be attributed or can be credited to A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Of course, it's interesting that Prabhupada himself would often say, you know, vegetarianism? What's the big deal about vegetarianism, you know? Even the pigeons are vegetarian, you know? It's like, what's the big deal? Yet society is giving him the credit that the spread of vegetarianism was very much down to him. I think also the last time I was here, if my memory serves me correct, and of course I could be wrong, but talking here at the Sunday program the last time, I think I mentioned about a character called, a gentleman called William Cowherd. Was that correct? Did I talk about him the last time I was here? Does anyone remember? Yeah, you do remember. Yeah. So that was also in the subject of vegetarianism. So in the 60s, 70s, you know, when you were becoming, I don't know what it was like here in Slovenia, whenever you were becoming a devotee or you became vegetarian, but it was quite cutting edge. It was quite a cutting edge thing, you know, to become a vegetarian. Now it's not. Now it's not cutting edge at all. It's like fairly standard. You know, it's not such a big deal. But Kali Yuga, and that's what so in one sense, the effect of Krishna consciousness is actually, you can see it in that context that, you know, before it was cutting edge, you were even looked on as being strange or odd, because it's such that Kali Yuga is so normal for people to be eating the flesh of animals. It's just a standard practice, and you see it all the time. Every shopping street that you have, it's not just butchers anymore that sell meat. It's every supermarket, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that does that. But now it's becoming sort of, no one is surprised at somebody being a vegetarian. Most restaurants will carry a vegetarian section to their menu. They'll carry an actual vegetarian section. Don't trust it, by the way. Never trust a restaurant that just has a vegetarian section, you know. You never trust them, you know. They're probably still putting, you know, chicken stock cubes in their vegetable soup or something, you know. You have to be very careful with that. But anyway, the pastime I wanted to relate to was the very beginning when this started, when animal slaughter started, and particularly the killing of cows started. And that was the king at the time was Maharaj Parikit, as many of you know, was Maharaj Parikit. He was the king. And he was just out and about surveying his kingdom. And he came across an incident he saw. The incident that he saw was the personification of Kali was attacking the personification of Dharma, Dharma in the form of a bull. And he had chopped off his three legs. Kali had chopped off the three legs of Dharma. And the only leg that was left standing was truthfulness. And we understand that truthfulness is the last virtue that is present in this age that we live in. Sometimes it's hard to actually, you know, see how that's a factual reality. there's a lot of lack of truthfulness in Kali Yuga too. People speak a lot of lies and a lot of rubbish. But anyway, that's the virtue that was left. That was the leg that was left. Now, when Maharaj Parikit saw this, when he saw in his kingdom, he saw somebody attacking Dharma, somebody attacking a bull. It was just horrific to him. Totally horrific. And again, as devotees, sometimes we get into this discussion about how much we should intercede and how much we should interfere, if you like, with what's happening in society or what's happening in our society or even what's happening in general society. And it's an interesting thing about getting the balance between the two, understanding that we are not the controller like that. We can't dictate anything. We can't control everything. But at the same time, we shouldn't stand back in a detached or impersonal way and not have views on things that are actually taking place, as I say, either in our own society or in greater society. So Maharaj Parikit, his role was, he was the king, so he was a kshatriya. That was his role in society. So it was his duty not to protect citizens. That was his duty. He used to protect the citizens. So definitely he wanted to interfere. So he didn't actually see the attack happening. Kali had just left the scene. Not completely left the scene, but he had left where Dharma was. He had just left a little bit. He was a little further away. So he went to Dharma and he asked him. He said, "Who has done this to you?" And he was asking from the perspective of, "I'm the king. I'm meant to protect the citizens, and I'm meant to also keep society free of sinful activity. And there is really no more sinful activity in society than the innocent slaughter of innocent creatures like that. So he wanted to know. He says, Dharma, who has done this to you? And what was Dharma's response? Now, this is interesting about getting the balance between when you intercede, when you interfere, and when you don't. And it also depends on the role that you have in society, and it depends on the nature that you have. But Maharaj Parikit was the king, so his nature was a kshatriya, a protector, and his duty was to protect the citizens. So he wanted to know, who has done this to you? But Dharma in that sense was the victim. And so he had a different role to play in this particular pastime. So his answer was very interesting. He said that it is very difficult to ascertain the cause of our suffering. I think he quoted, that's the verse where he says, very difficult to ascertain the cause of our suffering. Great sages and saintly people have meditated meditated on this for since time immemorial, and they are none the wiser of finding out what the cause of our suffering is. And then he, to Maharaj Parikit, he suggested to him that there were maybe 17 different reasons as to why this has happened to him. Now, actually, in a real simple sense, all that Dharma had to do was, it was this guy, he was dressed like this, he was carrying a sword, and he went that way about 5 minutes ago. If you chase fast after him, you'll catch him no problem. Because that's who did it. That was the person. He'd just come, he'd just chopped his legs off, and he just ran away. That's who it did. That was the simple answer. And for most of us, I think, because that's an interesting point too, actually, he had his three legs chopped off. So if we take it in the context of ourselves, it would be two legs chopped off and an arm. Now, you know, sometimes when you cut your finger, you know, I remember there's one devotee, still a devotee, and the slightest little cut that he would get, even someone else would cut their finger. But if he would see blood, he would faint. You know, he would faint like that. So, you know, having three of your limbs chopped off, it's a pretty horrific experience. And surely your reaction would be to just point the finger at the person who did it and, you know, go get him, you know, go sort him out. What to speak of having the presence of mind and the ability to be free from the bodily concept so much that the pain that you must be feeling is a little bit like Jesus Christ, as Prabhupada many, many times glorified Jesus Christ, that when he was being crucified and his response was, because you can imagine nails through your hands, nails through your feet and whatever else, they cut him in the side and all that, and the thorns on his head. I was wearing a garland this morning that had a few spiky leaves on it, and I said, oh, I have to take that off. It's pricking my skin, you know. So that was just the leaves of a garland, you know. Christ a crown of thorns on his head, the thorns digging in like that. Of course, that was the least of it. He had nails in his hands and nails in his feet. But yet his response was, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. It really indicates a great presence of mind, and it also indicates a great indication that someone is actually off the bodily platform, that they can respond like that when their body is in so much trauma. So Dharma was exactly the same. Three legs had been cut, and he was saying to Maharaj Parikit, well, some people say that it's due to your karma, your previous activities. Other people say that there is no cause. Other people say that it's due to the involvement of the demigods. And other people say, and he gave 17 different possibilities as to why he was standing there on one leg. He was given when actually it was just this guy came and chopped them off. I mean, that's actually what happened. So compassion. that was really the topic that I wanted to kind of focus on, the principle of compassion, both in the context of us not inflicting suffering on other living entities. If we want to advance in spiritual life, and that's why we're vegetarian, and that's why you'll see at every Hare Krishna temple, all the prasadam that we eventually eat is offered to the deities first, to also free us from the karma that's involved in the killing of the vegetables, etc. So compassion, that we do not inflict suffering on other living entities, and then also the compassion that we do not take revenge or take vengeance out on people who do us wrong. So it's a double-sided thing. It's not just one-sided. We shouldn't inflict pain on others. But also, if people inflict pain on us or inflict suffering on us, we should have developed our consciousness to the degree that we with an open heart, that we are happy to forgive them like that. Now, if others want to inflict punishment on them, in this case, Maharaj Parikit wanted to inflict punishment on Kali, that's okay, because that's their job, that's their service, that's their role in society. So it's okay for them to do that. But us as an individual, we should not be retaining that that hatred or that vengeance or that revenge in our hearts. We should develop ourselves in such a way that we are happily willing to allow that person or to forgive that person like Jesus Christ was, etc., etc. Now, Maharaj Parikit, interestingly enough, later on, he was cursed. As you know, he was cursed by the Brahmin boy Sringi to die in 7 days. And it's interesting that Prabhupada writes in one purport that Maharaj Parikit could have reversed that curse. He could have nullified that curse like that. There was no issue for him. He could have easily done it. He didn't have to. He didn't have to allow that curse to have an effect on him. So he could have saved his life, basically. But Prabhupada explains that because Jai Shishi Panchatattva Ki, very beautiful, a very wonderful focus in this yatra on Panchatattva and Gaunitai. Amazing. Yes, he could have reversed that curse. He didn't have to allow it to have its effect on him. But because he was, because his authorities hadn't indicated to him that he should do anything different, that he should do that, then he didn't do it, because he had no one was telling him that this is what should be done. And also, he wasn't attached. He was completely detached. In fact, as we know, it's a real benefit to know exactly when you're going to leave this world. It's actually a real benefit. It's such a challenging subject, because it's such a funny thing. Because on one level, we're all going to leave this world. There's nothing we can do. We have to leave this world. It's going to happen. In another sense, there's a certain amount of, it's a little daunting, if you're going to be told, well, actually, at 10:30 a.m. on the 17th of September, that's it. You're finished here. There's an element of, really? Really? Can I not get an extra week? can I get an extra 2 weeks and I can go to Corfu for a holiday? And then I'll come back and I'll happily leave. It's okay. So it's kind of daunting, but of course we know that it's a great benefit, because then we can prepare for that event, that occasion. And we can, try to develop our consciousness as best as we possibly can. So anyway, Maharaj Parikit, he was detached. This was happened. He had been told this. His authorities hadn't told him to change the curse. So he happily went. And from that we can understand another nice verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Udared Atmanatmanam Natmanam Uvashadayat, which means that the mind is our greatest friend, or it's our greatest enemy. And basically, the mind is our greatest friend if we're in control of it, and it's our greatest enemy if we're not in control of it. Yeah, greatest friend if we control the mind, and it's our greatest enemy if we're not in control of the mind. And we see people who are not in control of their mind, how much they're suffering. They're just suffering unlimitedly if they have no control over their mind. So Maharaj Parikit, in that sense, he was the most, completely in control of his mind. And of course, he was the king. And the system, it's interesting, Prabhupada explains that part of the Bhagavatam. The system then, it wasn't a democracy. It was a monarchy. He was a king and it was a monarchy and it was handed down. But of course, for it to work, the people have to be qualified. And he was qualified and therefore it worked. But it is interesting that now we all live in this thing called democracy. And of course, Western society really glorifies democracy. But even Western philosophers and Western academics, they will say things like, you know, democracy is the best of all the worst systems of government. Like that, it's the best of all the worst systems of government. But anyway, it's just interesting that Parikshit Maharaj, he was a monarch and he wasn't afflicted by the whole principle of democracy. Actually, Prabhupada once said that he talked about voting in people. This was during the time of Richard Nixon. You remember Richard Nixon in the, he was American president. And Richard Nixon's nickname was Tricky Dicky. He definitely was a kind of a, you know, he bent the rules, if not broke the rules. And it was during that time, and there was that whole scandal, the Watergate scandal. I don't know if you remember the Watergate scandal where he got his people to break into the, anyway, whatever the details were, but he was doing something he shouldn't have done. And Prabhupada said, yes, he said that, you know, if people are unqualified, of course Prabhupada said it a little bit more strongly, but he said if people are unqualified, I think what Prabhupada said was, if you ask all the dogs on the street to vote in an election, then what you're likely to get is you're likely to get the biggest dog who will be elected into government. So yeah, Prabhupada was quite critical of the whole democratic procedure. I think he said at one time that animals, cavemen had rocks to throw at people. We were talking this morning about Dravida gorilla, who, you know, threw all the trees at Lord Balaram and they had no effect. Then he threw all the rocks and mountains at Lord Balaram and Lord Balaram just smashed them away like a expert cricket player or an expert baseball player. So cavemen had rocks that they would throw as weapons at people. Animals have claws. They show their claws to the other animals to threaten people. And modern governments have nuclear weapons. What actually is the difference? You know, everybody is seeking to be the biggest bully in the schoolyard and to, you know, dominate and be the Prabhupada also made that point about going into another country. I was in India recently and I was meant to go 2 weeks before I went, but I had to renew my passport. And of course my visa was up. I had a 5-year visa. It was on my old passport. I had to get that back and this and that. But Prabhupada also gave that example of, you know, all of the world is God's, is owned by Krishna. It's God's property. It's not, we don't own it. But yet we then make demarcations, and then if you want to go into this part of the world, they stop you at the border and they want to see a visa. And Prabhupada says it's like dogs barking at the border. I remember one time as a teenager, I was going to Morocco from Spain. I was crossing on a boat to Morocco, and it was at night time. We arrived about 1 o'clock in the morning in Morocco, totally dark, and it was in a port, like a ferry port. And we went, we came off the boat and we had to go through the visa, the customs check. And we walked into the sort of warehouse. It was like a big warehouse. It was about, must have been at least 4 times as big as this room. And we came in one side and the whole room was completely empty. And just right down the other end, there was one guy sitting at a table with one little light shining on his desk. And he had his cap, which was turned around halfway, coming off the side of his head. He had his top button undone of his shirt like this, and he looked like he hadn't shaved for about 3-4 days, you know, and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and he just looked like the most, oh my God, it just looked like a really dodgy situation, you know, and you had to walk all the way through here and show your visa and hope that this guy wasn't going to give you trouble. But there's that whole sense of trepidation and sense, and now we have all these wars all the time, you know, what they're doing in Gaza, what they're doing in Russia and Ukraine, and it's all, the whole thing is people claiming ownership of this land that they don't actually own, and they're claiming ownership of it. And like I say, bullies, you know, we all want to be the chief bully in the schoolyard. I remember as a kid, I went to a birthday party one time, and, you know, I was about 7 or 8, something like that. One of the games that we were playing at the party was musical chairs. You know that game, musical chairs, they play, there's 10 kids, there's only 9 chairs, and they play music, and as soon as the music stops, you have to jump on a chair, and one person's going to lose out, because there's one, and then they take one chair away, and then there's 9 people, 8, 7 people, 6, 6 people, 5, like that. So we're playing this game, musical chairs, and of course, when the music stops, you're really eager to be really quick to jump on the chair, to beat the other people to the chair. So one of the kids, totally unknown to me, had put, you know, these cocktail sticks, these wooden cocktail sticks, had stuck one of those in the cushion of the chair. And of course, my karma, I was the one that found that particular chair, you know, and the music stopped, and you jump enthusiastically on the chair, you know, bang! But again, it's all about, you know, lording over and people wanting to dominate and dictate and intimidate, you know, to intimidate this tendency. And as devotees, it's not that we're completely free of that, but it's certainly good if we can learn to control those kind of things, you know. And the idea here, the example of Dharma, that he is, and Jesus Christ, that they're just willing to forgive the person for the wrongdoing. But then that's a higher principle. That the slightly lower principle is that we don't inflict suffering on others. And that suffering comes, adiyatmik, adivik, adibhotik. You know, we can also, it doesn't have to be a physical infliction of pain that we impose on people. It can also be a mental one. We should be kind and caring and loving. You know, they're the qualities of a devotee, a quality of a Vaishnav. They don't want to intimidate and make people feel uncomfortable and make people feel awkward. They want to make people feel as happy as possible, particularly their fellow devotees. So these things are very, very important. Whereas the non-devotees, they have a completely different psychology. Their psychology is, as soon as they meet someone, what can I do, physically, mentally, whatever, what can I do to make this person feel intimidated? And therefore, I'm in a superior position. And there's one really, just to elucidate on that, there's one really nice pastime, in relation to Srila Prabhupada, that he was invited. I hope I didn't tell this pastime the last time I was here, but anyway, I'm sure there's some people here that haven't been here. I don't think I did, but anyway, I can't remember. Prabhupada was invited onto a radio show in Los Angeles, California. I did? Ah, okay. Okay. Prabhupada was invited onto, it's a pastime that I just love so much. I just think it's so brilliant that, I do actually talk about it quite a lot. But he was invited onto a radio show in Los Angeles, California, in the 70s. And in America, at that time, they still have them actually in America, that they have what's called shock jocks, which is a reference to disc jockeys. Disc jockeys is a reference to people who present radio shows because they play discs. They don't play discs anymore because it's all electronic. But in the old days, they used to play disc records like that. So they were known as, I don't know why they're called jockeys actually, but they're known as disc jockeys. So from disc jockeys, you got this thing called shock jocks. And shock jocks are disc jockeys who want to shock. They want to be shocking and they want to shock. And you actually still do have them in America. It seems like the American public like that kind of thing. And basically, a shock jock is somebody who is basically very insulting and puts down their guests and tries to, you know, really minimize them and undermine them and treat them in a very, very nasty kind of way. That's the kind of style of presentation of these shock jocks. So this chap's name was Joe Pine, and he was one of the most famous shock jocks in America. Prabhupada was invited on, but before he actually went on, the devotee said to Prabhupada, "Oh, Prabhupada, I'm not sure that you should actually go on this program because this person has a really big reputation about being really, you know, heavy and aggressive and nasty and, you know, trying to make you look foolish and all of this kind of thing." And Prabhupada said, "Oh, and will I get a chance to seek and, you know, mention Krishna?" And the devotee says, "Well, yeah, you'll get a chance to speak, you know, but this guy..." And I said, "Well, that's okay. Then as long as I get a chance to speak and mention Krishna, then no problem." So Prabhupada went on the show. So he went on the show, and they're in the studio, and there's Prabhupada's with one or two devotees are behind him, and then this other fellow's there, the shock jock, Joe Pine, and he has his assistant beside him as well, who just happens to be a lady. And whatever, the music stops, and then this gentleman says, "Okay, so today I have with me a Swami from India, and we're going to ask him a few questions." He says, "Okay, Swami, why have you come to America? What are you going to teach us in America? You know, what are you going to teach us? Look at the death rate in India. How are you going to teach us anything?" So he's making this reference to whatever the death rate in India, the average age of people dying is 60 or 50 or whatever it was at the time, whereas in America it's like 70 or 80 or whatever it is. So he's just basically making the point that, you know, America is a more advanced society. It's a better organized society. And so what the hell are you coming to our country and what are you going to teach us? So he says, "So what are you going to teach us, Swamiji? Death rate in India is so poor, whereas in America it's so wonderful." And Prabhupada said, he said when he finished the question, Prabhupada says, "Oh yes, the death rate, it is 100% everywhere." So this guy, Joe, it's kind of funny actually, you know, because a lot of times people do get intimidated in those situations, but Prabhupada wasn't getting intimidated. He wasn't going to get intimidated at all. And of course that in turn then intimidates the person who's trying to intimidate. Not that Prabhupada's intentionally trying to intimidate him, but just by the fact that he's not being intimidated, the other guy then thinks, "Wow, you know, have to be a little careful with this fellow, you know." And then the next question, so he asks his second question, and he says, "I've done a little research on you, Swami, and I've done a little research on your books, you know, and I've noticed you said that the world is flat. How ridiculous is that, Swami? We all know the world is flat. How can you say the world is flat?" And Prabhupada says, "Well, it is everywhere I walk." So now he's feeling even more intimidated. He's had his set, and you can be sure that he only has a set amount of questions, you know, and he's hoping in his first two, three questions that he's going to completely smash the person that he's interviewing. So now he's asked his first two questions, and Prabhupada, without knowing what the questions were, had no idea what the questions were, he just answers both questions like really quickly, really spontaneously and really cleverly. And the guy's really, he's disarmed now. He's like, "Wow, this guy." So then he says, this guy, Joe Pine, he turns to his assistant and he says to her, you know, whatever her name was, he says, "Oh, maybe you have a question for the Swami, you know?" So she says, yes, I do actually. She says, "Why do you shave your heads?" Now, at this point, I think Prabhupada's getting into the mood of it a bit. He's probably picking up on what the shock jock concept is, you know, and he's probably understanding what they're trying to do. So she says, "Yes, why do you shave your heads?" And Prabhupada says, "Well, why do you shave your legs?" And then Prabhupada says, "I think it's better to have warm legs and a cool head than a warm head and cool legs. So now, then you're, the woman, whoever that girl is, you know, she just looks back at the guy Joe Pine as if to say, well, you know, I mean, I'm kind of finished, you know. Have you got any more questions? So your man Joe Pine, he says, okay, Swami. He says, okay, Swami. He says, you know, how would society run? What would happen if we all became like you? How would society run? You know, who would, you know, sweep the streets and who would run this and the industry and all this kind of stuff? So what would happen to society if we all became like you? And Prabhupada says, that'll never happen. There'll be always rascals like you who won't surrender to Krishna. he had finished. He had no more questions, but they had slotted the devotees to be on for about 15 minutes. And that had only taken less than 5 minutes, but they'd given the slot 15 minutes. And he had no more questions to ask. And there was a silence for a few seconds. And then Prabhupada said, so can I tell you about Krishna? And the radio guy just went, he didn't say anything, but apparently according to the devotees, he kind of nodded his head, okay, like that. And Prabhupada, because this guy was very popular, and he was in California, big population in California, and it went out the whole of Los Angeles. I think there's 10 million people or something in Los Angeles. And Prabhupada had the remaining 12 minutes to effectively give a Bhagavatam class to 10 million people, however many millions of people were listening to this guy's radio show. And Prabhupada just sat there, just basically giving a Bhagavatam class for the next 10, 12 minutes. And it was a kind of glorious thing, you know. So it was I just think it's a fantastic pastime. And Prabhupada, just to give a slightly different pastime with his devotees, because in that sense, Prabhupada is being quite, of course, he was just responding to the challenge that this person was presenting him. But Prabhupada was, you know, Prabhupada had that in him as well. He was quite feisty when he needed to be, and he was able to challenge people. But then just to give another side to Prabhupada, the very first Vyasa Puja that Prabhupada ever had in ISKCON was actually in Tokyo. I'm not sure it was in Tokyo. It was in Japan. I don't think it was Tokyo, actually. I think it was another city. But anyway, it was in Japan. It was the very first Vyasa Puja ceremony that Prabhupada ever had. And there were a few devotees there. And one of them was Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and he was there. And this is in the early days of Krishna consciousness, you know. So in that sense, you know, things were new. Devotees didn't know so much about all these different things. And at one point, Prabhupada said to Tamal Krishna Maharaj, can you get me some puspa like that? So of now, if someone was asked to do that, it's kind of like we know exactly what to do. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he goes into the kitchen and he gets a devotee to actually prepare some pushpana rice, you know, fancy kind of rice. And Prabhupada's wondering why it's taking so long. But anyway, eventually, you know, Tamal Krishna Maharaj comes back with some rice, pushpana rice, you know. And Prabhupada says, no, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean rice. I meant flour, you know. Now, then Tamal Krishna Maharaj goes back into the kitchen and he comes back with a bowl of wheat flour for Prabhupada, you know. So, but Prabhupada is just laughing, you know, just laughing and having fun about it. But just the in that sense, the kind of things that Prabhupada had to also tolerate, you know, with his disciples in the early years, you know, it was just interesting. Anyway, just to give a little opposite of the Joe Pine story. Okay, I think I was supposed to stop at 4:45, right, or 4:45. It's now 4:50. But if anyone has any questions or anybody has any comments to make, please, I'm sure we can go till a few minutes more, right? There's a couple of minutes more. So anybody with any questions or any comments? Please feel free and brave. Consider yourself Joe Pine. And, you know, and I promise I won't give any smart comments. But maybe I'll take this gentleman's first at the back and then yourself and then yourself. I don't know. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't actually. It was quite a long time ago that I read that. However, I tell you what I would remember. I would remember about a more recent article, which if you give me your email address, I can send to you, which I thought was quite inspiring. And that was that one company, I can't remember the name of the company, but a fairly well-known company, big organization, you know, that's involved in doing surveys and all that kind of stuff. I can't remember who it was. Anyway, I have it on my computer. But, you know, big organization. They ran a survey. Exactly how they ran the survey, I'm not sure, getting feedback from other people, other organizations, giving their own input and this and that. I'm not sure the exact modus operandi of the survey, but it was a well-researched survey and whatever. And what they were doing was they wanted to find out who were the most exceptional pensioners in the 20th century. Pensioner being somebody over the age of 65. So they wanted to know who was the most exceptional pensioners, the top 10. They came up with a top 10. And it was interesting, you know, in third position was somebody called Laura Ingalls. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of Laura Ingalls. No? You didn't grow up with the same television that I grew up with as a kid. Laura Ingalls was an American author. And she wrote some different books. One of the books that she wrote was a book called Little House on the Prairie. And Little House on the Prairie became a big television show in America, and subsequently it came to Britain, and I don't know if it went to other parts of Europe. And it was a big, big popular television show, and my sisters used to watch it all the time, so I was forced to watch it when I was a little boy, you know. It was a real girly thing, you know. Because it was about Laura Ingalls and how she grew up on the prairie in America and all this kind of stuff. So she came third in this thing, because she only started writing those books after the age of 65. Now, it's interesting because, you know, writing books, you know, I write some articles sometimes, and some devotee in Chowpatty, you know, he took all the articles that I've ever written, that I've put on Dhanavats in different places, and he took them all, you know, about 20 of them, and he compiled them into a book, and he sent me like 100 copies of this book. You know, I didn't even know anything about it. So in that sense, I do have a book. But anyway, you know, I'm sure writing books isn't the easiest of things to do. It takes patience and talent and all of that kind of thing. But still, it's a one-dimensional thing, an author, just writing books. It's like a one-dimensional thing. Prabhupada, in that sense, himself, you know, wrote and translated so many books. You know, it's incredible. So he was doing that anyway as an author himself. There was another gentleman. His name was Fauja Singh. And Fauja Singh ran his first marathon, 26 miles. He ran his first marathon when he was 78 years of age. And he continued until he was 100. He's 104 now, and he was still running marathons at the age of 100. Apparently he's toned it down now. He only runs about, you know, 10 to 12 kilometers a day, you know, and he's 104, you know. So again, and he came fourth in this all-time list, or second or fourth anyway. So again, that's, you know, on the level of, you know, I mean, gosh, if I went out there now and ran a marathon for 26 miles, you know, boy, I think then, you know, I think I wouldn't need someone to tell me when I'm going to leave my body. I think I'd leave it sometime on that run. You know, because marathons, you know, 26 miles is a big thing and the whole thing. And what to speak of at that age, he first won at the age of 78. So in and of itself, it's impressive. You know, and I'm sure there's probably nobody in this room that will achieve what Fauja Singh achieved. But still, two things about it. It's one-dimensional. It's just one thing he's running. It's a one-dimensional thing. And also, you know, it's running. You know, if you have legs, you can run. You know, it's not exactly a sort of an earth-shattering, groundbreaking discovery for mankind. You know, it's like it's running. You know, they've been doing it, you know, well, you know, they make out, of course, we would greatly dispute this, but they would make out that running became popular when, you know, the cavemen were running after, you know, animals to bring home some food to the family, the Fred Flintstone kind of era. So, but it's running, it's one-dimensional. So there are all these different people, authors, runners, and when I was reading it, I was thinking, gosh, you know, there's nothing that really jumps out at you until you come to number two. And number two was A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, was number two. So I don't have that article where they were giving credit to Prabhupada for spreading, but being the main personality who influenced Western society to vegetarianism. But as I say, it's kind of ironic. It's probably not something that Prabhupada would have been particularly proud of, because he didn't consider vegetarianism such a big deal. But coming second in that survey, I'm sure Prabhupada would have been a little bit appreciative of that, because it explained what his achievements were. And his achievements weren't one-dimensional. They were multifaceted, what he did. You know, he basically transposed a culture or a tradition from one part of the world to the rest of the world at such an advanced age. He translated so many books. The Bhagavad Gita is the largest, most distributed or most published Bhagavad Gita than any other Bhagavad Gita in the world. And it talked about him opening so many temples around the world, farm communities, you know, and gurukulas, so many different things like that. So it was multifaceted and it was significant. You know, it wasn't just running, you know, okay, it's great, 78-year-old running, but, you know, transporting a culture from India to the rest of the world was a real achievement. So I do have that. I can give you that link and show you that. Yes. Yes, the other three legs. One of them is austerity. And that's why we don't like austerity in Kali Yuga, because that's not part of, that leg has been cut off. But austerity is one. Cleanliness is another. Cleanliness, particularly as it relates, there's internal cleanliness and external cleanliness. So external cleanliness is that we should regularly, shower, take bath. And then internal cleanliness is related to, because the four legs of religion, they're all related to the four principles of liberation, if you like. It depends on your consciousness. For some people, they're the four principles of liberation. For other people, they're the four principles of imprisonment, you know. So the four principles of liberation, as are presented by Srila Prabhupada and the Vedic scriptures, are to be free from the desire and the need to eat animal flesh, like that, and that's then that's then connected to the leg of religion that is compassion that I was talking about earlier. You cannot develop compassion if you're eating the flesh of animals. You can't do it. Because for you to eat that flesh, an animal has to really suffer. Actually, I've often said, I do quite a lot of presentations in secondary schools and kind of colleges and that in Ireland and Dublin. And I often make the point that if I had any authority or if I ever got into government, the first law that I would pass is that every secondary school student, before they leave school, you know, they normally leave school 16, 17, that kind of age. Before they leave school, it would be compulsory part of the curriculum that they would visit an abattoir, a slaughterhouse. That it would be compulsory. Because in our modern society, so many people are growing up, even myself, and I'm not young anymore, but even when I grew up, you know, my only experience really of meat was that it was packaged nicely in cellophane package and, you know, with a label on it, and it all looked very pucker and clean and neat and tidy like that. But where does it actually come from? You know, also when I was growing up on television, there was an ad, McDonald's. McDonald's had been around a long time. McDonald's actually had been around since the end of the Second World War, a few years after. I think they started in 1948, 49, that kind of time. And where did they start? They started in California, you know. All of these things start in California. Prabhupada said that, actually, you know, the further west you go, the greater the Maya is, you know. And, of course, California is about as far west as you can get, you know. So McDonald's started in California. And it's interesting, McDonald's, how they operate. They have airplanes flying over America and taking photographs of the landscape. They have other people checking with all the different public authorities in any given city or any given state, finding where the next motorways are going to be built. So 10, 20 years even before a motorway is completed, McDonald's have bought land on that motorway where it's going to be. When they buy it, it's just desert, like in Arizona or Utah or any of these places. It's just desert, just scrubland. Nothing's there. But McDonald's buy it for nothing, for next to nothing, because it's just cheap land. And then 10 years later, 15 years later, even 20 years later, the motorway eventually gets built. And as soon as the motorway is built, the first thing you see is a McDonald's restaurant is there, you know, because they bought the land. They know this is going to happen. They also work out if they reduce the amount of tomato ketchup in their sachets by 1 milliliter, they will save, you know, $10 million a year on all their restaurants, reducing just by 1 milliliter. No one will miss 1 milliliter, so if they, but they'll save $10 million or whatever the figure may be. The other, this is a book, I read this in a book, by the way, it's called Fast Food Nation. It's a very interesting book, you know, Fast Food Nation. And attacks on McDonald's, hold-ups, you know, hold-ups, people go in and hold up a restaurant or a bank or whatever it is to get money, hold-ups. I can't remember the percentage, but the majority of hold-ups on McDonald's restaurants are by ex-employees. Like that. Anyway, I'm getting into the Fast Food Nation book. It is a very interesting book. But what was your question? Compassion. Yeah. McDonald's. When I was growing up, there was an advert on TV, and it was for McDonald's. And you know Ronald McDonald, the clown. I see some heads shaking, right? Ronald. He wears the fluffy red and yellow thing, and he's a clown anyway, and he's red and yellow, you know, because that's the McDonald's color. So this ad on the television was a little girl came into a McDonald's restaurant with her family, with her mum and her dad, and she was a little girl there, and she came into the restaurant. And they go up to the counter, and a girl comes with a big, nice smile and says, "Oh, hello, how can I help you today?" And the little girl says, "I'd like a Big Mac." And the girl goes back and then comes back again and says, "Oh, very sorry, we don't have any Big Macs today." And the little girl gets all distressed and she starts to cry, you know, and tears are coming down her cheeks, you know, because she'd been waiting for a Big Mac all day or whatever, and now she can't get her Big Mac. And next thing, Ronald McDonald comes bouncing into the restaurant, you know. "Oh, here's Ronald McDonald," you know. And he takes the little girl by the hand, and he walks with her out the back of the restaurant. Now, actually, I run. I don't really run, actually. My wife runs them. But anyway, I'm associated with some restaurants in Dublin. And, you know, whenever you go out the back of a restaurant, no matter how hard you try, it's always a mess. There's always rubbish and this and that. It's just the way it is, the nature of the business with all the waste and all the stuff like that, you know. Ronald McDonald brings this little girl out the back of the restaurant. Sun is shining. There's a big field out the back, you know, and it just looks so perfect and idyllic, you know, and so wonderful. And he brings her into the field. And what part of the field is all cabbages. There's a whole load of cabbages in the field. And he brings her into the field, walks down a few rows, and comes to a big healthy looking cabbage with the bottom leaves on the ground. And he lifts up one of the cabbage leaves. And have a guess what's under the cabbage leaf. A Big Mac. And he picks up the Big Mac and he brings it into the restaurant, gives it to the girl. Girl puts it on the thing, cooks it, gives it to the little girl who's the customer. The auto-suggestion to children is just incredible. How they're actually allowed to get away with it, I don't know. I actually don't know how they're allowed to get away with it. Because that auto-suggestion that somehow or another Big Macs are coming from cabbage leaf, coming from cabbage patches, it's extraordinary. Where Big Macs come from are abattoirs. They come from cows, cows who queue up like that. And I've been to an abattoir. I've been to one. They queue up. And the queue oftentimes is 100 cows, maybe 150 cows, all waiting to be slaughtered. But the cows know when they're queuing, those cows know what's happening to them. And progressively as they get closer to the front where they're actually going to be killed, they are perspiring, they're urinating, they're passing stool, and they're squealing. That's the biggest thing of all, this high-pitched squeal. They're basically screaming for mercy. That's what they're doing. They're screaming for mercy. Crying for mercy, actually. They're crying for mercy. crying for someone to come and help them and to protect them and save them from this fate, you know. That's where Big Macs come from, you know, not from there. So compassion, we cannot develop compassion as long as we're eating the flesh of animals. It just doesn't work, you know. And all the religious traditions, if you look deeply enough into them, they all have people who espouse this philosophy. You Teresa of Avila in the Christian tradition, you St. Francis of Assisi in the Christian tradition, you have the Sufi Muslims in the Islamic tradition, you know, like that. So it's just a core principle. So compassion. So the liberating thing is that we're free from the desire. And I think for devotees, I think it's a relatively easy thing. There are very, 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 statistically, I think the amount of devotees, even when they stop practicing Krishna consciousness, the amount of devotees that go back to eating meat is statistically so small it almost doesn't count. It's so small. So I think for devotees, that's a very easy thing to achieve. You just couldn't conceive of it anymore. Not least because prasadam is so glorious and wonderful and tasty. It's just an amazing thing, you know. And as Bhagavad Gita tells us, as long as you have a higher taste, you won't fall back to the lower taste. So that's relatively easy for us. The second one, austerity, that I mentioned, that's related to the liberating principle of gambling, that you're free from gambling. And again, for most devotees, it's a relatively easy thing. It depends how much you define and analyze what gambling is, of course. You know, like Prabhupada would say, you know, like Prabhupada said, Prabhupada said one time, a devotee went to him and asked him, you're going to love this. Everyone in the room is going to love this quote from Prabhupada. You're going to love it and you're not going to like it as well, simultaneously. It's one of these love-hate ones, you know. They went to Prabhupada one time and they said to Prabhupada, is there ever a reason or ever an excuse, ever a reason why you wouldn't go to Mangalarti or why a devotee wouldn't go to Mangalarti? And Prabhupada said, yes, death. you can argue that if you don't go to Mangalarti, you're gambling. There's an element of gambling involved. You could argue that, you know. You could argue if you go to the cinema to watch a movie, there's an element of gambling involved. But in the traditional understanding of gambling, it's very much, it's a wonderful verse in Bhagavad Gita, Mayi Sarvani Karmani Sanyasyatma Chetasar Nirashir Nimamo Budva Yujas Va Bigatash Vara. And Krishna is saying to Arjuna that, therefore, surrendering all your works unto me, Arjuna, giving up your desire for profit, your desire for profit, fame, adoration, etc. It gives a list of things like that. And free from feverish mentality, shvara, feverish mentality, stand and fight, do your service. So gambling produces that. You know, if you see people, they bet money on something, they become very eager to know, oh, have I won, have I not won, have I won? And if they lose, they want to bet more, you know, they want to bet more. And people literally, you hear people, men who get their paycheck at the end of the week and they go into the bookies for horses or the place where they pull these machines and they just spend all their money like that. And they give nothing to their wife, nothing to the family. They're just the swara, that the feverish mentality of wanting to win is so powerful like that. So that's compassion, is freedom from the desire to eat meat, austerity, freedom from the desire to gamble, and then cleanliness, is freedom from the desire to engage in illicit sex life. Now, this one is a much, much more difficult one for everybody in the material world, and that includes devotees, to overcome. Prabhupada says there are two reasons the material world exists. Oh, sorry, not two reasons why it exists, two reasons why it keeps going. The two reasons why the material world keeps going are sex and money. Without sex and without money, the material world will come to an end. Like that. So it's such a powerful pull on the living entity, the desire. And you see it if you watch these nature programs, you know, the only things they ever show in nature programs are eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. They're the four things, the only things they ever show, how the animals or insects eat, how they sleep, how they defend themselves, and how they reproduce. And the reproduction thing, having an heir. We spoke this morning in the camp. We spoke this morning about Henry VIII. Henry VIII, because of his desire to have a son, he killed two of his wives, And he divorced two others and whatever, you know. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. That was the way his wives went. So this desire to reproduce, basically to have sex life, is so powerful. Penguins, the penguins as well, maybe, but whales and sharks and all these things, they swim like from the North Pole to the South Pole, to mate and to lay eggs and do whatever they do, you know. And penguins, they go in all extreme conditions because of this desire to reproduce. So this desire that we also have, we have that animalistic tendency, is very, very powerful. So, you know, we have to be mindful of that, and we have to be really focused on how we can, overcome it. Because if we don't overcome it, and this is why it's a liberating thing, you know, is that we're a slave to it. It's like, you know, when I do some of these programs in schools, you often get asked the question, oh, you're not allowed to smoke. Now, I'm in my 50s, you know, and they ask me that question, and I say to them, are you kidding? Of course I'm allowed to smoke, you know. I then go out to the shop next door, and I can buy myself, you know, 20 smokes and the fags, and I can smoke them all in one go if I want to. However, I choose not to smoke. I choose not to smoke. And then I always ask them the question, do you smoke? And usually the person who asks me the question about smoking, they usually smoke. And I say, do you smoke? And they say, yes, I do. And I say, and that's the difference between me and you. I choose not to smoke. You cannot stop smoking because you're addicted to smoking. So it's not that I can't smoke. I choose not to. But you can also choose not to, but you're not able to because of your addiction to cigarettes. So it's the same with any of these things, also sex life. You know, in the 60s, we talked also about that at the camp, you know, the women's liberation movement. You know, basically throw off your bra and run around, you know, topless or whatever. Of course, the women's liberation movement was actually started by a man. And like, why not? You know, great, you know, get all the women throw off their clothes, you know, and the men can have a great time. But the point is, they think it's liberating. That's their mentality. I'm liberated now. No, you're not liberated. You're addicted to this thing and you can't control it. You can't stop it. Much better, udared upmanatmanam, natmanam, uvashadiyat. Much, much better to be in control of your mind rather than your mind dictating. As we know, the mind is like the epicenter of the senses. And the senses are just all the time wanting to be engaged. They want to eat, they want to sleep, they want to mate, they want to defend, they want to do all these things all the time. And the mind is just the epicenter, the facilitator, how to do it. We need to be in control of that epicenter so as that we can decide what's best for us as eternal spiritual beings like that. So cleanliness. Cleanliness is the leg of religion, and the liberation is freedom from the desire or the need to engage in sexual activity. And then the last one is truthfulness. So truthfulness is related to, what are the four vices now? I've forgotten them. Compassion, meat eating, gambling. Oh, sorry, intoxication is austerity. I'm very sorry. Intoxication is austerity. Do I need to go back and explain that? I don't think so. Truthfulness is gambling. Truthfulness is gambling. I'm sorry. And intoxication is austerity. Because you cannot be austere if you're intoxicated. And you can see that with people. Once a person is intoxicated, it's impossible for them to even hold a rational conversation. What to speak of, perform austerity and be controlled in what you're doing like that. So yeah, sorry. Intoxication is austerity and truthfulness is gambling. And obviously, truthfulness and gambling is very obvious why they're connected, you know, because if you're gambling money and losing money, so many gamblers end up engaging, just like drug addicts, they end up engaging in stealing and cheating and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, they're the four legs of religion related to those four principles of liberation. Audaya.
I would just like to ask you, today you mentioned that you would like to say one Lila with Srila Prabhupada and nicknames.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Are we on camera? I don't know if the devotee will appreciate this, but I'm sure it'll be okay. I know him. Anyway, it'll be okay. There's one devotee, Prabhupada disciple, called Satadanya, okay? And he is from New York, originally. And actually, his ancestry is from Russia, actually, and Russian Jews who moved, you know, I don't know, at the turn of the century, whatever it was. I'm not sure. And they settled in Brooklyn, in New York. Anybody who knows, anybody been to New York in the room? Anybody visited New York? Okay. So if you visited Brooklyn? No? Okay, you visited Brooklyn? You know, it's a fairly rough area, you know. And it's one of these areas where, and it also gets hot at this time of the year in New York and Brooklyn, where the apartments are all quite close by. So windows are open, etc. So the neighbors all sort of know each other and know the family, know what's going on and the whole thing. Don't know if you ever, did you ever see a film, was it, I think either it was, this wasn't in New York actually, but I think it was either Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or it was the other one was, what's the one down in, Louisiana, Marlon Brando, A Streetcar Named Desire. A Streetcar Named Desire. I don't know if you ever saw that film. But this picture is what you're talking about. It's like close proximity living. And because it's hot and windows are all open and doors are open, everyone gets to know everyone else's life, you know. So, you know, the person next door knows that the family next door, the husband and wife, are always arguing together and always, you know, and they even know what the arguments are because they hear them all the time. So it's kind of like that, like that. So Satadania grew up in a situation like this in New York and Brooklyn. And he was a bit of a case as a kid, you know, caused trouble and was, you know, whatever, you know, he's a bit of a case. So, one time, his neighbor, who was above him, I think, she wasn't really a friend of the family, but, you know, she was like a neighbor, she knew the family, she was an older woman, to him, of course, you know, and he was just doing something, being bold, being naughty, and she was just totally fed up with him, and she said to him, she shouted down from her apartment, because they could hear it below, she shouted down, she said, "Stanley, go play in the traffic." Like he's only like 6 or 7 or 8 or something. He's a young kid, you know. Like, go play in the traffic. You know, it's like, you go out on a busy road, you start playing in the, you know, you're going to get knocked down, you know, you're going to have an accident, you know. So she's saying, like, she's basically saying, go kill yourself, you know. Go play in the traffic, you know. So he told Prabhupada this story, you know. And then Prabhupada didn't do it forever. He did it for a short period of time. It wasn't actually forever. But he would say to him, "So I'm looking at you. It's your question. I'm sorry." He would, for a few days after that or a few weeks after that, he would call him Stanley. You know, he was initiated. Prabhupada had initiated him, but Prabhupada would put on the New York action. "Stanley, go play in the traffic." like that. So Prabhupada, there were other examples of those nicknames as well, though, actually. It wasn't just that example, but that was the example I was thinking of when I said that, you know. Okay, listen, thank you all very, very much. Always wonderful to come to Slovenia and Ljubljana in particular. Great time at the summer camp. Wonderful. Thank you again to all the organizers, Audaria and Prema Gopi and Ananta Prabhu and also Uruklam and his brother, Abhinandan Prabhu, and everyone else who was involved in the organizing, and not just the organizing, but also all the devotees who were doing all the helping there, all the cooking and all the cleaning. I remember you helping there at the festival. This devotee who did the sound, working so hard, doing the sound the whole time. I don't know everybody's name. Durlaba Gorahari, have I remembered your name correctly? Yes, fantastic. And Daniela, who looked after me so nicely while I was down at the summer camp. So thank you all very, very much. Always very wonderful to come here. It's a wonderful yatra, very vibrant yatra, you know, very energetic and enthusiastic yatra. And I know that if Srila Prabhupada was here and was to come here, he would be so excited with what's going on here. Just even here at the Sunday program, and you've got so many people. It's fantastic, you know. So please keep up the good work. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki.